75% of Americans believe in UFOs. 30% of Americans believe UFOs are vehicles from other worlds. And 3% of Americans believe they have been abducted by aliens. That's over 8 million people. They're out there, aren't they? Welcome to the UFO Files with your host, Jerry Pippin. And now, here's Jerry.
Well, welcome to our show. Here we are in Laughlin, Nevada, at the beautiful Flamingo Hotel and Casino on the Colorado River. And we have an interesting hour. Stan Gordon will be joining us in a moment. Stan, you may be familiar with the Kecksburg incident. He, of course, is on the Sci-Fi Channel when they did the thing about Kecksburg. And he's a researcher that's been around for a long time. So I think you'll enjoy Stan Gordon. That'll be coming up here in a moment on our UFO Files program today. Having a great stay here in Laughlin, Nevada, as usual, on the beautiful Colorado River. Looking out the window here, I can see Bullhead City across the river, not too far downstream from Davis Dam. If you've never been here, it's a nice, relaxing place. Especially in the fall and spring and the winter. In the summer, it gets a little hot. And that wind gets a little cold sometime in the winter. But by and large, it's one of my favorite places to go and has been for a long time. Always look forward to broadcasting from Laughlin when we get a chance. The interesting thing about Laughlin, I think, is that it has all of the sizzle of Las Vegas, yet it's still got somewhat of a resort, homey attitude about it. So come to Laughlin if you ever get a chance. Well, lots of things happening, you know, with Mars. You keep hearing all of the stories about Mars, finding water on Mars, spending $1 billion. Got a couple of rovers up there. A lot of people wondering why we're not over at some other places where things have piqued people's interest through telescopes for a long time and satellite pictures. And Larry Dickin, of course, our producer and co-host when we do the sightings reports, and I've discussed this quite a lot. Speaking of Mars, I mentioned at one time this Edgar Rice Burroughs novel. It's interesting that I find out now by reading Daily Variety that Paramount Pictures is going to make a motion picture about this this novel. It's called A Princess of Mars, and they're, I guess, going to try to develop a series or at least maybe a few different movies about it. They think they can develop this thing into a franchise. It's an adventure series. It's an action series, and it's sci-fi at the same time. And then there's a sizzle of Mars. It's, of course, a little far-fetched from what really could be happening on Mars. Edgar Rice Burroughs, most famous for writing Tarzan, wrote about that. And really, it was almost like some of the movies originally made by Mel Gibson and the governor of California, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, look, Stan Gordon's coming over to the table. We'll be talking to him next, but first of all, we're going to pause for these words. I'm Jerry Pippin, and you're listening to the UFO Files.
Oh, Jane, you remember the Italian place?
Where we had that homemade ravioli.
Oh, that was so good. And the salad with the prosciutto.
And that pesto dressing was out of this world.
Croutons.
Oh, yeah, so good. Oh, let's eat there.
Where was that?
I don't remember.
Well, what was it called?
Oh, it was so good, too. What was it called?
What was it called?
Ooh, look at this. Homemade biscotti.
Let me see the ad.
Ooh, and fresh pasta.
Hey, let's go there instead.
Out of sight, out of mind. Don't let the world forget about you. Advertise. A message from the Radio Advertising Bureau, Adweek Magazine, this radio station, and the famous Radio Ranch.
Jerry in Laughlin, Nevada at the Flamingo Hotel, and Stan Gordon. We ran across each other in Nevada in the last 2 months or 3 months twice.
That's correct.
I just have to figure out where your schedule is and make sure I'm next there next time. We got a roll going.
Oh, that's for sure. We'll see what happens. I know I am going to be scheduled for the new paranormal conference they're having in Denver in November this year.
In November, so we'll keep everybody attuned to that and your schedule. I know you've got this, and we talked a little bit about this documentary last time, and you actually have it here at the hotel, and it's available at the conference. And tell us a little bit about this.
Well, this is a documentary I produced myself in 1998 called Keksberg, The Untold Story. It's a 92-minute, very detailed account of a lot of information, a lot of witnesses we interviewed, a lot of little-known facts about the Keksberg case, and a lot of information which has not been on television. And it's 92 minutes long. It's available on DVD and VHS now, and people can obtain it and order it through my website at www.stangordon.com. There's also other information on the site concerning Keksberg, UFO sightings, other phenomena, Bigfoot, cases we've investigated in Pennsylvania, and a lot of other links as well.
And, of course, we do have a link to that as well on our website. And, Stan, this actually has more information than was in the television special, right?
Well, there's been several specials. The Sci-Fi Channel, of course, recently did the two-hour special, which was very well done. And they all took a different perspective. There's so much to cover. It's impossible for anybody to cover in one program. So they've covered a lot of things, and this includes similar material plus a lot of other information as well.
Now, you've been investigating other things besides Keksberg, and we want to get into Keksberg before you leave the show, but you've got some pretty interesting things going on now in Pennsylvania.
Well, I've had a UFO hotline open in Pennsylvania since 1969. I started researching phenomena when I was 10 years old back in 1959. I've been out in the field since the 60s, and I've worked on thousands of cases. And UFO sightings, Bigfoot, other strange animals, all kind of anomalies, and reports come in on a continuous basis. My hotline's been very active. I have quite a good input of free information from the news media, law enforcement people in Pennsylvania, and I get lots of emails coming in daily pertaining to these events.
Now, that hotline number, it's on your website, but maybe you give it to the radio listeners.
Sure. It's area code 724-838-7768. They can also write to me at P.O. Box 936, Greensburg, PA 15601.
We'll give that telephone number and address and the information. They can order the DVD there as well.
They can call me directly. You can write to me. You can get the ordering information off the website, and you can just mail in, or you can order through the PayPal through my website on the website as well.
Well, that's interesting that you've talked about this DVD before, and I know when I watched the Sci-Fi Channel one, for instance, you had some pretty interesting things that were developing, and not all of it was on the channel at the time.
Well, the investigation continues. I mean, I have a lot of input coming in, even from more recent people, witnesses coming forward who were involved in the case or people who have other knowledge pertaining to the case. The investigation continues from the Coalition of Freedom of Information backed by the Sci-Fi Channel with the investigation trying to uncover more information on it. And, of course, on December 9, 2003, the 38th anniversary of the event, they did file a lawsuit with NASA pertaining to the event at Keksberg.
Talking with Stan Gordon here, and we're talking about Keksberg and other things that he covers in Pennsylvania. Interestingly enough, one thing that I really would like to follow up with you is this fact that this truck driver or whatever saw this egg and body hanging or sitting on a little ramp or a bench or something there. Tell the listeners a little bit about that, and if there's anything more to it, have you been able to verify that or whatever?
Well, that's something I uncovered actually when I was working on this documentary. In fact, the interview with that gentleman's on this one I produced, and I didn't know about it until we went to interview him. We had previously talked to him. Investigation had been done with information we had obtained from him and a second truck driver who was also involved in the event. The late Leonard Stringfield helped investigate the case as well, the pioneer involved in UFO crash retrievals. And I got to tell a bit of a story first, because people probably don't know the whole scenario, what happened. You want me to give them a brief?
No, I would love to hear the whole thing set up again, because you're right. We get new listeners. People are not familiar with it, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, just very briefly, late afternoon, December 9th, 1965, multitudes of witnesses observed this brilliant fireball moving across the sky over a large geographical area. The object comes in over the greater Pittsburgh area. There are multitudes of phone calls to the police departments and news media. People seen this brilliant object in the sky. Some people thought an airplane exploded. What we now know is that the object proceeded roughly eastward into Westmoreland County over the city of Greensburg, made a turn towards the south, was reported by various people along the path in the rural communities out there. It moved towards the south, towards the village of Laurelville. Out in that area, it turned, began to proceed back now towards the northeast and turned down into the woods outside of the village of Kecksburg. The people saw it come down said, this didn't come down at the high rate of speed. It appeared as though it was making a controlled landing. It came in very slow. It was coming parallel with the ground. It came in slowly, went down into the woods. And what we now know is that some locals got down there and saw the thing, semi-buried in the ground, and got down there and saw it before the military arrived. What witnesses say they saw was a large metallic acorn-shaped object with like a raised-up area on the end that had unusual markings that some feel would look similar to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. The object, again, semi-buried in the ground, estimated to be approximately 10 to 12 feet or more in length, about 8 to 10 feet or so in diameter, tall enough for a human to stand inside of it. And what was interesting, no rivets, no seams, no fuselage, no weld marks. It looked like one perfectly solid piece of metal. The military came into the area within a relatively short period of time. There are some witnesses that swear that at least a very small contingency began to come in even within an hour or so into the general area. They may not have known where to go to the crash site because you're talking about a lot of woods and a lot of mountains out there. But during the next several hours during the evening is when a lot of the military began to show up. And I've interviewed hundreds of witnesses who were involved directly or indirectly, and so many saw Army personnel, Air Force personnel. Others claim to have seen NASA personnel involved in the event. Others talk about men in dress suits who were involved in the event that seemed to be very powerful and may have been running the operation or certain aspects of the operation. And what we now know is the military, we definitely feel the military recovered the object, according to eyewitness accounts. It left the area around 1 o'clock in the morning on a large military flatbed tractor trailer truck with a tarpaulin over it, came out of the area at a very high rate of speed with a military escort. And what I've now obtained from other sources is that the object was taken first to Lockbourne Air Force Base outside of Columbus, Ohio, got there in the early morning hours, December 10th, was under very, very heavy security, was backed into a hangar temporarily. The guards, the security team, was given a shoot-to-kill order to anybody approached it without the proper identification. It wasn't there very long when it was taken over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, here's where we get into the story of Myron. Myron contacted me after the Unsolved Mysteries did a show on this in 1990. Myron said the reason he's calling me now, since it's on television, he thought he'd be allowed to talk about it. Because when this happened, he said he was threatened, was told not to talk about it, or they put him in jail and throw away the keys. But in 20 years, this would all be public knowledge. And, of course, that's not the case even today, over 38 years later. Myron said that he worked for this large supply house in Ohio, that a Navy representative brought in an order, a large order for a special type of glaze engineering bricks to be sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So the orders came through. Another truck driver took the first load into Wright-Patterson, which we interviewed him, and he was very reluctant to talk to us, but finally he did, and he verified that, yes, he was there the day before Myron was there. And when he got there, here is a flatbed trailer outside of this warehouse building at the base, and on it is this large object that he described like a Liberty Bell shape with a tarp over it. The next day, both he and Myron went back with truckloads of these bricks. They were escorted in. They're told to stick with your vehicle, don't be looking around at anything. But Myron became very intrigued by the fact that there was personnel going in and out of this warehouse building with white coveralls, with sidearms, with some type of protective gear. They appeared to be Navy from the what he could see. They were related with the Navy, not the Army or Air Force. And they are periodically changing outer clothing. So he waited till everything looked clear, and he went in and looked from the entrance into the building, and he said, up on the scaffolding, here's this big bell-shaped object, kind of a bronze color, has a raised-up area at the bottom, strange markings on it. There's ladders going up to it. They have like a parachute on top with a light down, not lit real well. Parachute-type device is kind of hiding this thing, and these guys are working on this, apparently trying to get inside of it. Well, apparently there was a little bit of communication with one of the people there, and at first must have thought he had clearance, but soon realized he didn't, and that's when basically he was threatened and told, if you talk about this, we're going to put you in jail and throw away the keys. But in 20 years, this will all be public knowledge. So he kept quiet. But when we went to interview Meyer, and we had already interviewed him about that aspect of it, but we were all kind of shocked when he told us something else. When we got there, you could see Myron was not in good physical shape. He was on oxygen. He had lots of other physical problems, didn't look real good. And he said there was something else he had to tell us. And he goes on to describe that besides seeing the object, there was a table. And on the table was a body. And the body wasn't real large, approximately 4.5, 5 feet tall, he estimated. There was a white covering over it, a sheet or something over it. And he said all he could see was an arm hanging down off the table with 3 index fingers. And to him, the skin looked reptilian. And that's all he saw. He wouldn't exaggerate. We tried to make him change the story. He wouldn't do it. He said, that's all I can see. And he said the only reason he's telling the story now is because of his condition that he may not be around later to do it. And that's kind of intriguing because there's kind of a more recent development now. November 2002, as our local media was covering the stories about the Sci-Fi Channel doing a very serious investigation of this, more and more people began to come out of the woodwork again. I mean, periodically, I get this, but as this was coming out, others who were involved, there are so many people involved in this case, it's just amazing. And they started to contact me about their experience, the experience they knew of others or friends or relatives who were involved. Some were now deceased. A particular name came up, and we'll call this person Joel. This guy's in his 60s, a retired fellow, worked in the area for years. But I recognized the name, and I recognized the name from input we had maybe 12 years before when we were given a source that indicated they thought this fellow had been down in the woods that night, had watched some of the military recover the object. So we contacted him back then, and basically he would not say it didn't happen. His big concern was that his family didn't want him involved, and he was concerned the government might go after him if he said and described what he experienced that day, and that was his big concern. He wouldn't talk to us. So now, in November 2002, it comes up again. And we did talk to him, and we arranged to have an interview with him. When I got out there, he said, you know, I thought about this, and I was going to call you and just cancel it because my family doesn't want me involved in this. And his big question to me was, well, have I ever been contacted by the government and threatened? And, of course, I said, no, I have not been. And he said, well, he was concerned the government might come after him. Anyhow, we proceeded with the interview, one of many, spent a lot of hours with this fellow. And like he said, I'm getting up in age. Things started to get a little confused. There's some things I remember very clearly. He remembers a lot of details, but he said, you know, things are starting to get a little changed, but there's some things I do remember very well. And he gave me lots and lots of details. And a lot of it fits in with what we know from other sources. Some of it's not well-known information. And some of the things he said helps to clear up some of the little mysterious aspects. We couldn't figure out a piece of the puzzle that didn't fit. But anyhow, what he goes on to say is, as we're talking, all of a sudden his demeanor changes. And you can see there was something beginning to bother him. And he began to come out with this, that besides the fact that he was down in the woods, he sees this like electrical arcing and attracts attention to it, that he's hiding down in the woods when the military's starting to come down. And he said, and he had been in the Army himself, so he knew Army, Air Force. And he said he watched an Army general jump onto the object and got on top of this thing. And he had some kind of a tool that he said it was similar to a policeman's billy club, but it was longer. And he said, for whatever reason, this officer struck the object with this tool, and he hit it so hard it bounced out of his hand. And he said momentarily, like within seconds after he did this, on the front of this object was like an appendage that stuck out from the front, which is something that was not very well known.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, everybody always talks about it was slick and covered up.
Well, it may well be that other witnesses now didn't see that, but it could have been that by the time he got there, some of the dirt may have settled around that thing. But some other witnesses who saw it close up or saw it going over described this protrusion out to the front. But he said it was like a valve, something along that line, that it opened. And he said it opened up. And this long arm came out and went up and over it. And he said all he could see, the way it was positioned, when that latch was open, was like two fingers. And he said it was like very elastic and very elongated. And he said it was a matter of seconds. And he said that closed. And he said when it closed, you could hear it hit metal on metal real loud. And he said there had to be another arm to pull it down, but he couldn't see it from where he was. So all he could see was this long arm and two fingers. But there's some similarities with what Myron described. So you have to wonder, what was there something inside of this thing? Was everybody's imagination? And then you got to look at, for example, what witnesses described in the scene, such as Bill Weaver, a very competent witness, who's up in the lane where various people were that night on the side of the wooded area where a lot of the military presence was. And Bill describes seeing this big box van pull up. And out of the box van are his four fellows in what he called the moon suits, protective gear. And they had this box-shaped device that he figured was about 4 or 5 foot square. And they took it down on a stretcher-like device. The four of them carried this down into the ravine. Other witnesses described seeing it as well. Now, the box is too small for the object, so what was the purpose of the box? What were they going to put in it? Of course, we don't know.
It makes you think that maybe they're putting this beam.
Well, we don't know that. As I've specified many times, there has never been any reports of anybody seeing an actual body at the site. But
what about the scream? That's kind of new, too, isn't it?
Yeah, but what I want to emphasize is the fact that there have never been any bodies at the site, but there have been rumors for quite a while that allegedly two bodies associated with the object were recovered. That's all I can tell you about that. The scream is something relatively new. This, again, came from a fellow named Don Sebastian, a very competent witness. He kept his mouth shut for quite a while. He didn't live in the area. He lived near Johnstown, about 40 miles away, but he and his buddies, they were teenagers at the time, heard the breaking news stories about the alleged UFO crash that night. So he, like so many others, began to come into that little rural community to try to see what was happening. Well, by the time they got there later in the evening, there was roadblocks and roads were shut down, and they said he was there with his friend and his friend's girlfriend. And he said, man, we came a long way just to see nothing. So he didn't want to take no for an answer. He was stopped at a roadblock. State police stopped him, pulled up the road, pulled off. And at that point, as I recall, his friend's girlfriend was crying, was getting pretty upset, didn't want to get out. So her boyfriend stayed in the car, and Don got out, and he found his way past the hit and got past the roadblock and found his way down into the woods. Again, they didn't know the area. He describes generally the same farm lane that all these other witnesses describe where most of the activity was taking place. And he came across two large trucks, which he told me initially were like large military flatbed tractor trailers, which other people described seeing two flatbed tractor trailers out there. And actually what he did, he climbed on top of one of these things and looked over top of it so he could look down into the ravine. And he said these trucks had very bright searchlights on. The one in particular he was on was shining down, and he said there were soldiers right in front of him that were armed, but they apparently couldn't see him because the bright light was shining in their eyes. And he said, what's so amazing is I'm looking down there, and I can clearly see down at the bottom of that field in the ravine, approximately maybe around 100 soldiers, all walking in a single-line formation with rifles at hip level aimed towards the woods. And he said, these guys are walking along. He said, it looked like they may have done this before, the way they were such perfect precision. And he said, all of a sudden, there's this horrifying scream. And then moments later, there's a second one. And he said, at that point, after hearing this, he didn't wait around any longer. He said, it just made the hair on the back of his neck stand up. And he got out of there and ran back to the car, told his friends about it, and got out of there. Now, what the screams are, how they relate to it, of course, we don't know.
It's interesting it'd be so long before that story of the scream comes out. But I guess in your investigations, that's the way things work. People, I don't quite understand, but that's, I know in things I've done, people talk to you and talk to you, and then all of a sudden they mention something that really you would think would be the first thing they'd talk about.
Well, you got to also understand, on the side he's on, it's far away from where most of the crowds are, okay? I mean, if you see the geography of that area, if you're not at the right place at the right time that night, you couldn't see what was going on. He's on the far side of the woods, where hundreds of people are jammed up on this little narrow road overlooking the area, but they're far on the other side, and that's where most of the activity is. Those people up there, including most of the media, apparently had no idea what was going on the other side of the woods where all this activity was happening. And like so many witnesses I've interviewed with the case, the small number of people that you've seen on TV being interviewed is just the sampling. The majority of people I've interviewed don't want any publicity. These aren't people. I mean, this is a small community. know, these are a lot of quiet people. A lot of these are, some of these are VIPs now, very credible people. A lot of these people are now engineers, school teachers, police officers. But back then, they were young kids or teenagers who were involved in this event. And when they grew up, they became educated. A lot of them are in high-placed positions, and they don't want any publicity. So that's something I've dealt with, and that's what's so interesting about this case, because most people involved don't want any publicity, and their testimony in so many cases verifies other people's accounts that they don't even know.
We're talking with Stan Gordon, and we're talking about the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania incident right now. Stan is a UFO investigator of some note, and we will talk to him about some of the things he's been involved in lately, because it's not all just Kecksburg.
Oh, that's correct. UFO reports come in all the time. And, of course, a lot of reports, UFOs, creatures, Bigfoot, whatever, while a lot of these cases seem to be strange on the surface, of course, when we've investigated them, and when I had my research group for years, we had many cases we looked into, and most turn out to be a natural man-made in origin, but there's that percentage of cases you get every year you can't dismiss. And many of these, especially UFO cases, are just amazing cases. Not lights in the sky, but sometimes large structured craft observed at very close range, some in daylight, many times by multiple eyewitnesses, in some cases where there's physical evidence or physiological effects have been reported over the years in some cases. And some of these cases are just amazing. And you still hear these cases, not like you did in numbers back in the 60s and 70s, but they still occur.
We're talking with Stan Gordon now. The thing that comes to mind every time I talk to you, Stan, about this is the fact, where's the Kecksburg story going? Is it dead, or do you think if there's two creatures or two people or two whatever discovered there, they had to go someplace?
Okay, let me reword that question.
Okay, basically, I'm saying if there were two creatures that they found, like you're saying that that's been a rumor, where would they have taken them?
Well, again, the rumors persist that allegedly there were two bodies associated with the object that were recovered. We don't know if that's even true. This is kind of new with the two different people claiming that they saw basically just appendages, okay? And we don't know how that associates. But if their statements are correct and they're true, then we have to look at the possibility that there was someone or something inside the object. And, of course, we know the object ended up a Wright Patterson. And that one witness, Myron, says he saw that what he saw on the in the building was that Wright Patterson.
My question or the point of it is there's no evidence other than just this peripheral thing, the stories you're hearing, but do you have a place you're following? Do you think they're still at Wright Patterson, or is there a place that you don't have any idea?
Oh, of course we have no idea. Myron tells me, he said, even today, if he could get access to the base, he drew me maps, including street names, everything. He said, I could take it right to the building. Now, of course, whether the object's still there today, of course, we don't know. Probably we'll never know.
Is there any way, how does the military treat you? You said that they had not really ever contacted you.
Well,
have they?
There have been many attempts through the Freedom of Information Act. I started that back in the 80s. And, of course, the Coalition for Freedom of Information, backed by the Sci-Fi Channel, has been very busy with their FOIA efforts to get data on this for the last year. And, of course, right now they're persisting with the investigation. We're tracking down various leads. And, of course, they filed the lawsuit against NASA pertaining to the event, which is, you know, right now that's very new information. And I don't have the dateline on it, but probably within the next several weeks there's going to be some kind of response from NASA as to what exactly, you know, their response is going to be concerning that FOIA request.
Basically, what I was getting at is a lot of people are deathly afraid of the military because they say, hey, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail or whatever, but no one's really ever threatened you as an investigator, right?
I have never been threatened, and some things have happened that are kind of odd pertaining to the investigation. I didn't reveal this till the MUFON conference in 2000 when I wrote the paper on it, but it wasn't until 1987 that we had located our first actual eyewitness who saw the object on the ground. Up to that point, it was eyewitness testimony, seeing this fiery object, something coming down in a large wooded area, but not knowing the exact location where it came down and the fact that nobody had actually seen an object up to that point. Well, it wasn't long after we had this information from this witness, and of course there had been some news media coverage of it, and I had done some radio talk shows and all about it, that some oddities began to happen on a more personal level, which other people were able to verify. Another relative, my first wife, others who can verify the story. First of all, I began to have a lot of things happening in my mail, especially mail pertaining to the case coming in from other countries, so it would be neatly slid open. And that was happening kind of frequently for a short period of time, as I recall. The other thing that was more interesting was that, and this is something I hadn't heard until other people in the family heard it, because I had phone lines upstairs and downstairs, and what they were finding was that apparently somebody was monitoring the conversations in our home, not just a bug, but they were actually listening to conversations, because you could pick up a phone downstairs and hear every sound upstairs in the house amplified 100 times.
You know, we've done shows about that. Evidently, the government has the little receiver in the phone. They do not even have to call you or anything. It's just there.
Right, and that was going on. Then another event happened where a person in the house, there was a knock on the back door, which would be unusual to come through our back door, and a fella came around, and this is when we were having problems with the phones, electrical noises, interference, that type of thing going on, and we never reported it. And he came to the back door, and he said, "I'm here from the phone company. We understand you're having some phone problems." And party said, "Well, basically, you know, we didn't call anybody. You have some ID on you." And he said, "Yes, yeah, in my truck. It's up in the front." He never came back.
Interesting. So there's some pretty good evidence, or at least you have a clue, that maybe you were under surveillance at least at that time.
Well, that's when some interesting things were beginning to break. You had the first eyewitness. Investigation was intensifying. More information was starting to come in. And so there could have been some interest at the fact that they realized we were on to something.
We're talking with Stan Gordon. We're here at the Flamingo Hotel in Laughlin, Nevada. And Stan Gordon is an investigator mainly in Pennsylvania, but today's electronic media, especially the web, people are apt to call you any place or email you.
Well, I get a lot of calls from around the country, throughout the world. I deal mainly in investigating Pennsylvania cases. I do keep in touch and monitor what's going on worldwide so I can compare with the local reports. But, I get quite input from quite a lot of areas.
Now, what's happening in Pennsylvania besides Kecksburg? There's other things going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, last year was a very active year. I had reports on 44 counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania of strange, unusual happenings. And that's just what we heard about, or other input I had from other sources. That's what we heard about. How much went on we didn't know about. That was UFO sightings, strange creatures, unusual, unexplained sounds, strange footprints, all kind of anomalies were being reported. And even this year, and I haven't had a chance to really fall on too many yet, but several reports have come in January and February, at least one alleged Bigfoot sighting, which sounds like there's something to it, some other UFO cases. Probably one of the more interesting cases, which I think I did email to you, was the last day of 2003. January 31st, very interesting sighting.
That was interesting. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
It happened up near Ligonier, PA, around 1:30 in the afternoon, as I recall. Woman's driving down one of the main roads, Route 30, heading, I believe, was westbound, and she observes this object flying through the sky, coming down in her direction on the opposite lane, but moving in her direction. At first, she thought it was a big bird, but then realized there's no wings on it, and it's coming closer to the car, that it gets very close. And what she's seeing is a large cigar-shaped, well, not large, it's a cigar-shaped object, only about 12 inches in length. And it's metallic, and it has these unusual, like, lines going down the side. And it comes real close to the car, it stops, it reverses direction, begins to pace the car, follow it down the road, and it comes up right in front of the car on top, hovers, and then shoots right over top of the car and disappears. No sound to it.
You talked a bit about Bigfoot sightings too, and that's an interesting thing you just told me. Like I said, that's that must be some kind of new model of an orb, I guess. An observatory. I'm not sure what that is. 12 inch cigar is all about.
Well, those are very rare. I mean, over the years, I get reports of these small spheres anywhere from a few inches to a foot in diameter, and those I've investigated quite a number of cases where they've and seen in outside in daylight. I've had cases where people had open windows in their home and they went inside their house and flew around and went back out the window. I had one case, it was amazing, Jack, geez, 20-some years ago, where a lady had one enter her house and was flying around the kitchen. She got her broom, struck it, and she said it split into two identical objects and then flew out the window.
This is Stan Jordan, and we are going to talk about Bigfoot or something like that.
Hi, Bars Dick.
Oh, hi, Dick.
Okay, I talked to every advertiser in America and the U.S. territories.
Good.
Even Micronesia and the state of Yap.
Good, Yap.
Everyone's ready to start advertising again.
Great.
They now realize that consumers are ready to spend. I'm talking every single advertiser.
Yeah, except Debbie.
I thought you told me Debbie was in.
No, this is a different Debbie.
What's this Debbie's problem?
Well, she said the agency's new creative doesn't speak to her.
What's the product?
Dog food.
Does she have a dog?
No.
Does she eat dog food?
No.
Then she's not the consumer.
No, but she's really ticked off at their spokes dog.
Oh, a prima donna. Uh-huh.
Prima dog. This dog wants his own trailer, masseuse, use of the company jet.
Company jet?
Wait a minute. I know how we can get Debbie on board, Dick.
How about
get rid of the dog and get a new spokes creature.
I played a chicken once.
He played a chicken once. He played a chicken one. It's called advertising, and it works. Your competitors know this. Why don't you? This message brought to you by this station, Adweek Magazine, the Radio Advertising Bureau, and the famous Radio Ranch.
Internationally acclaimed private eye Joe Culligan has a new book or video that may answer these questions. How much alimony does he pay? How much child support does he pay? Did he really graduate from college? What assets does he own? Does his divorce file say he beat his wife? Is he all he claims to be? Has he ever been arrested? Does he have a history of drunken driving? And much, much more. Before you agree to marry anybody, before you take on a new business partner, before you begin any serious relationship, don't put yourself in danger. Order P.I. Joe Culligan's When in Doubt, Check Him Out. The book or video is just $19.95 plus postage. Ship anywhere you wish, to anyone you care about. We'll ship confidentially. To order by credit card, call now, 1-800-921-9898. That's 1-800-921-9898. Specify the book, the video, or both. Don't risk your business or your life. Call 1-800-921-9898 now.
We're talking with Stan Jordan, and we are going to talk about Bigfoot.
Bigfoot Ridge is a mountain range that runs about 100 miles long from Preston County, West Virginia, through Westmoreland, Fayette, and Indiana County. It's a continuous hotbed for all kind of phenomena, UFO sightings, Bigfoot, underground sounds, things falling out of the sky, mystery animals. Year after year, reports come in from different people all along that path. And so many strange, unusual happenings out there. And I've investigated hundreds of alleged Bigfoot sightings, basically from the 70s up to the present. And back in 1973, just an amazing series of events happened, something I'll never forget. It was the most amazing thing I've ever been involved in. Had I not been directly involved, I'd be very reluctant to report or even talk about it. And I did publish this a year later in the MUFON Symposium, and amazing story. I mean, the summer of 1973 was a very hot summer, as I recall. A series of events began to unfold, which went on for actually weeks and months. It wasn't an isolated event. And this all started out in late July 1973 when I received a phone call from a relative of a person who had been admitted to the hospital, which seemed to be related to the event that he had been involved in. As soon as he was out, I went to the house and interviewed him. And basically what happened was July 31st would have been the date, as I recall. The gentleman, it was a warm summer. Gentleman was shaving in the bathroom one night. It was hot. He had the window open, and he smelled this funny odor. He said, like a rotten cucumber, and he turned around to look, and there's these two glowing red eyes looking at him in the window, which is over 8 feet off the ground. His dogs are outside, but the dogs aren't making any noise, something we found very commonly in other cases as things unfolded. And slammed the window shut, ran out. The other people smelled the odor, came back out, and of course, nothing there. So apparently, the next day he had a heart-related problem that was he thought was associated with the event. Was taken to the hospital and went out to interview him as soon as he got home. When I got out there, I found out that there was more than just that story. I found that several young fellows, a number of weeks before, probably a month or two before, had been walking along that area near the old Green Gate Mall, a lot of woods and brush at the time. They heard a commotion, and they thought it was a deer in there. So they started throwing rocks in there, and instead of a deer, here's this large, hairy, man-like creature, about 8 foot tall with long arms, big gate crossing the road, went up behind the woods, up behind their house. So I had the chance to interview some of those fellows. They seemed very straight, gave me the story. I said, you know what, I'd really like to go up there and take a look around. So I went with several of those people up in the woods, and lo and behold, we came across an area where there was what appeared to be a partial track, as I recall, but one very clearly defined, very strange three-toed footprint, 13 inches long and 8 inches wide, which I made a really nice cast of. You can see the bone structure, the muscle tone in it, and I called on the radio. At that point, I had one of my first research crews very active. We had a lot of scientists, engineers, research people. We had a two-way radio system set up that I designed. And called one of our photographers to come out, took pictures, make castings. While we're out in the field, we get a radio call from one of our members north of Pittsburgh that he had been investigating an incident that morning, and the police were involved, where a man had seen a tall, hairy creature looking through the window of a trailer about 9 feet off the ground, seeing glowing red eyes, and they found very large... Over the years, well, that was the beginning of the series of events that happened in 1973 that was going on for not just days, went on for weeks and months. And what's so intriguing is this was not happening in one small little community. This was going on over a seven-county area in western Pennsylvania. It was also taking place down in the eastern part of the area, down and around Lancaster County, where the Pennsylvania Dutch were, where the farmers down there were reporting these big, hairy creatures were carrying off their ducks. And it was amazing because so many of these sightings were coming in from sometimes multiple eyewitnesses. Some of these were daylight sightings at very close range within 100 feet. Sometimes multiple creature sightings, large ones and small ones seen together. And in many of the cases, there was physical evidence at the scene. Now, again, this is when I had my group going. We had kind of a unique group that I set up. That was my determination years before to get quick response teams of research people involved in this. We did this all out of our own time and pocket. We didn't run our regular jobs, but we had some equipment. We built equipment. We had a lot of equipment we used out in the field to document this information, but we were on the scene sometimes within minutes to hours after these events happened. And because this was being taken very serious by the police and they're being deluged with calls, the police quite often referring to reports to us to investigate. And in some cases, we would meet the police department or state police out at the scene of the events and be there simultaneously. And it was just amazing to go out and see the animal reaction. Something could not be fabricated. People can be fooled, but the animals can't. And in some cases, especially when these creatures were close to the dogs, dogs were terrified. Dogs wouldn't bark, they wouldn't move, they're almost like paralyzed when these things were close by. And in some cases, they wouldn't even eat properly for a few days later.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, stories about that Bigfoot creatures don't like dogs, and dogs evidently are terrified of them. Do you have an explanation of why there hasn't been a dead body? I guess they bury their own, huh?
Well, that gets into some of the really strange cases we began to uncover during that event, okay? As reports are coming in, our feeling at first was we're dealing with some type of unknown zoological animal, but why so many reports? And again, we knew there were multiple reports and more than one creature because more than one creature had been seen together, and in some nights we would get simultaneous sightings from widespread areas. We'd be on the scene of one place, we get a call from the police to go to another location to investigate. And I mean, at that time, I was lucky because I was managing a small little electronics firm at the time, and I had a lot of vacation built up, and I took a whole month off of work just to work on this full time. And I had people manning my communication center in my home 24 hours a day. Phone lines were just jammed 24 hours a day with calls. It was an amazing series of events to live through. But again, we at first thought we're dealing with some unknown type of animal. And then some real unusual reports began to come in. One of the first reports was from two women north of Pittsburgh who reported a white Bigfoot and in its one hand was a small glowing sphere of light. Okay, that was one of the things. We began to get other reports. UFO sightings in one area, then shortly after a Bigfoot sighting and vice versa. Things like that were going on. And then we had a very spectacular report, and I'll just give you a brief summary. Occurred on the night of October 25th, 1973. About 10:30 that night, I got a call from a state trooper from the Uniontown State Police Barracks. He just came back from investigating a multiple witness UFO landing and creature sighting. He indicated to me that he felt there was something possibly still there, that we should send our team up as soon as possible. Well, it was a distance away. So we got our team together, and we got our equipment and started heading up that way. It was early morning until we got up there. But basically, the story is about 9 o'clock, there's about 15 people in this rural community out there, and they see this very large red sphere of light, about as big as a barn, dropping slowly from the sky towards this pasture. Well, the farmer's son, who was quite a big fellow, and two neighbor boys decided to go up and look at it. So he grabs his 30-06, grabs some ammo, he has some live ammo, and he also has some tracers. So they begin to move up towards the pasture, and when they get up there, here's this object about 250 feet away, apparently sitting on the ground or right above it. And it's now bright white like a half a dome. There's this very loud, high-pitched sound coming off of it, like a whirring sound. And they're also hearing the second sound, like baby crying sounds back and forth. Well, they're watching this thing in amazement. They can't believe what they're seeing. And there's a fence line about 75 feet away. And along this fence line, there's these two tall figures walking along the fence line slowly in their direction. The fence post is 6 feet tall. These things were much taller. One was 7.5, 8 foot tall. The other one's a little bit taller. Thought at first they were bear. Then they realized these things are bipedal. They're walking upright. They have very long arms, almost hanging down to the ground, covered with long matted hair. They have glowing green eyes. There's a funny stench in the air. And at one point, the one boy starts screaming, yelling to shoot at him. He's getting very scared, and he takes off, runs back to the farmhouse. The other fella does shoot a tracer right at them, and it's just a flash. Fires a second tracer, and he's at that point, the largest of the two creatures like reaches out like to grab the tracer. And the moment it does that, this is really interesting, the object in the field just disappears. It doesn't take off. It's just the light goes out, the sound's gone, and it's gone. The two creatures turn around, start slowly walking back towards the woods. At that point, the other two fellows run out of there, go back to the farmhouse, tell the family what happened, get them out of there, go to a neighbor's home, call the state police. Well, about 45 minutes later, the trooper arrives, and I'm here to investigate the incident, the flying saucer, and of course the witness said, forget about it, you can think we're all nuts, and the trooper said, no, I have to investigate. We had a report of two similar creatures, another location last night. So they go up in the patrol car up into the pasture field. They go over to the area where the object was resting on the ground, and the trooper said, at that location, the whole area was self-luminescent glowing, about 100 to 150 feet in diameter. He said it was bright enough, if he had a newspaper, he could have read the newspaper from the light coming off of it. He said he had a flashlight, he was aiming the beam into it, you could barely see the beam. The farm animals wouldn't go into it, they tried to push the animals and they wouldn't go into it, and he was perplexed. So anyhow, they start walking around along the edge of the woods where they saw the creature, witness the reporter, and they hear something heavy walking with them. They'd stop and take a few more steps. They'd move, it'd move. They were starting to get a little nervous. The state trooper would never verify this part of the story, but the witness did right up to the point where he passed away a number of years ago, and I believe the guy's telling the truth. He said, at one particular point, they hear a noise. They shine the flashlight. About 10 feet in front of them is the largest of the two creatures. Between the creature and them is his fence. He has one round left. He fires right into this thing, and this thing charges at them, hits the fence, and they run into the patrol car and get out of there. At that point, they're radio into the barracks. They both go to the barracks. They're both separately interviewed in two different rooms. And after that interview, I'm contacted, and we sent our team up. And it's a real interesting. I mean, there's more of the story. Dr. Berthold Schwartz, the well-known psychiatrist, came up and spent a week up here interviewing all the people. Even wrote this up in a journal. And you can go to my website and read more about it. But it's a great case. But then there was another case that happened not too far from there in February of 74. As these series of events were still occurring but slowing down, that might give us a reason why we have not been able to catch one of these things. This happened again in February 74 up in Ohio, up in the mountains, very rural mountainous area. Old mountain woman lives in a country out there, a nice little mountain home. Heard this commotion behind her house in the junk pile out there. They've been having trouble with wild dogs. thought that the dogs were back, so she loads her shotgun, is going to fire over the head to scare them away, opens the back porch of her home, and instead of being the dogs there, here's this very large, hairy creature. I'll never forget what she said. She said it was a great big, hairy ape. And she said there's this big creature, hairy creature, with his hand, with his arm straight up over its head, like it's surrendering, and she fires right into it with her shotgun. And she said there was a bright flash of light, like somebody took a picture, and it disappeared. Now, that's not the end of the story. Her son-in-law and family live in the trailer 100 feet away. They hear the gunshot. Call on the phone. She tries to explain what happens. He grabs his 45 automatic, starts running over to the house, and he said four or five of these creatures with eyes like coals of fire surrounded him. He starts shooting randomly at them. They run into the house, look out the window, and here's this UFO, like a big crystal thorn with different flashing lights hovering over the trees at the same time. Well, they call the state police. Now, some of you listening will remember it was in February of 74 that we had a nationwide trucker strike. There was gas rationing, you might recall. And I couldn't get up there that night because we couldn't get gas and it was snowing. So we got up early the next morning. But the state police and the National Guard, who were called out because of the trucker strike, both responded to the scene. And when they got up there, they were amazed. Now, the creatures were gone, but the animal reaction, here there's cattle and horses huddled together, and here's all these big dogs, like a German Shepherd, Eskimo Spitz, in their cages, and these dogs wouldn't move. They wouldn't bark. They wouldn't move. Remember the one state trooper tell me how he reached inside and grabbed and tried to pull the dog out? The dog should have ripped his arm off, and the dog didn't move. And he said it was so amazing to see how these animals were responding. It's something very strange happened out there.
Now, have there been any major sightings, like for lack of a better word, a flap of a Bigfoot creatures since then?
No, nothing like this as far as ever happened in history. There's never been such a long-time occurrence of so many dozens and dozens and dozens of reports went over, you know, a few-month period by so many eyewitnesses and over such a large area. And why it happened, who knows? We have no idea. Nothing like this ever happened before or since. Yes, we get periodic reports of Bigfoot sightings every year, not like the numbers we had in 73, early 74, but you get reports every year. And I have to stress, most Bigfoot sightings are seen by themselves. Most UFO sightings are reported by themselves. This is a very small percentage of cases like this. And I am not saying there's any direct link. I can't say that. But there's no doubt whatsoever, and these are just a couple examples. I'm aware of many cases around the country where similar things have happened. Even here, the last couple of days, other investigators come up to me and said, yeah, we have cases like this, but so many of the investigators are reluctant to publish it because they're afraid of being ridiculed by their peers. And my position as investigator is to document the information, to get it out, and those can accept whatever they want. I'm not trying to prove anything. I don't have the answers.
Incredible, incredible story. Now, I'm going to let you go here, Stan, but before you do, let's talk a little bit more about the DVD. It is available, and it's about Kecksburg.
Right. It's called Kecksburg, the Untold Story. Won the 1998 EB Award for the Best Historical UFO Documentary. Very detailed, a lot of information about the case that's not been seen on television. It's available on VHS or DVD, and you can order it either by writing to me at P.O. Box 936, Greensburg, PA 15601, or you can go to my website at www.stangordon.com, and you can order it through PayPal through my website.
And in addition to that, you do have the hotline, and let's give the hotline because you always pick up new people when you do a radio show.
Well, it's area code 724-838-7768, and my email is paufo@westall.com.
Stan Gordon, always a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for fascinating stories about all of these things and a lot of new information, as far as I know, about Bigfoot.
Oh, yes. Every year, reports are coming. As I said, we just had a real recent report that we're following up on right now.
Thank you very much. That's Stan Gordon, ladies and gentlemen.
Prince Anthony was the handsomest man in the entire kingdom.
Man, am I handsome.
His fondest wish was to find a beautiful bride.
Of course, she doesn't have to be as stunning as me.
But Prince Anthony couldn't find one. Why? Well, because he never left the palace.
Being this pretty isn't easy.
He spent all day lifting weights and getting his back waxed.
And
trimming and grooming and tweeting and flipping.
Perfecting perfection.
Meanwhile, his less good-looking but far more charming brother Benji found a bride, so did his rather unattractive cousins, and even his flat-out butt-ugly Uncle Stanley.
I don't understand it. I am way better looking than any of them.
Unfortunately, none of the women in the kingdom knew this because none of them had ever seen him.
Not if they ever did.
But they didn't. So Prince Anthony spent his entire life all alone until he was old and toothless, bald and fat, saggy and rather flabby.
At least my back isn't very hairy.
You may have the best product or service in the world, but if nobody knows about it, you just have the best product or service in the world. It's called advertising, and it works. Your competitors know this. Why don't you? This message brought to you by this station, Adweek Magazine, the Radio Advertising Bureau, and the famous Radio Ranch.
If you're looking for adventure, information, and entertainment on the internet, one stop fits all at jerrypippin.com. At jerrypippin.com, you'll find multimedia entertainment at its best. Almost 2 million people are enjoying hours of entertainment and information. Hit it now. www.jerrypippin.com.